Welcome to the Sober Butterfly Podcast. I'm your host, Nidhi Movina, and this week's episode is all about a dancer's story. Let's play a quick word association game. If I were to say the word stripper, or exotic dancer, or adult entertainer, what comes to mind? I highly doubt sobriety, recovery, or even empowered. My next guest is actually all of those things. She's a Las Vegas stripper, she is sober, she's in recovery, and she's a fucking badass, okay? Excuse my language, by the way, get used to it because this episode has a ton of profane language. So if you have little ones around, maybe send them to bed, or I don't know what people do with their children, just don't have them listen to this podcast necessarily. What I really love about Reagan Riley is just how honest she really is. It is super hard to talk about some of the things that she gets into, but she does it with such like humor and also with such like heartfelt emotion that at points I thought I was gonna cry just hearing her story. I'm sure you guys are super eager to hear her story, and trust me, you'll hear her own words. Just a quick life check-in. I am having the best time in Bangkok, where I actually filmed this episode, so there is a little bit of a lag in terms of the audio. That is totally my fault, so not the best quality of sound, but the message is still really pure and worth listening to. So I hope you really enjoy. Let's get into it. I am joined today with the lovely Reagan. Reagan is an exotic dancer from Las Vegas, or she lives in Las Vegas, and she is sober. So I am here to pick her brain because I am very curious to learn more about A, her story, B, what it's like to maneuver that landscape, like the club scene, as a sober woman, and also just understand how she maintains her sobriety. Reagan, thank you so much for joining me today. How are you this morning? Or for me, it's morning. I'm in Bangkok. But for you on the West Coast, it must be like nighttime, right?
Yeah. Awesome. I'm doing good. Thank you for having me on your podcast. I still get a little nervous doing recordings and stuff because off camera, I'm really open about my story. But, you know, when you're recording it, you know it's going to be going on the internet. It's like, whoa, you know, it kind of is a different flow.
Just to ease into the conversation, I wanted just to ask you a little bit about early childhood or your adolescence as a whole. So I'm wondering what your relationship was like with alcohol in terms of early development. So like, what did that look like in your household, for example, environmental factors and influences?
I remember growing up around drugs and alcohol. And I guess like one of the first times I was exposed or noticed it was when I was in sixth grade and I found a bong behind the couch and I didn't know what it was. The first time I drank alcohol, I was 14 and me and a friend did the typical, went into her parents' liquor cabinet and we poured three different types of alcohol into a water bottle. It was tequila and vodka and whiskey. Yeah. And we poured it in and drank it. And the first time I drank until I blacked out and threw up. And I was like, dude, fuck yeah. Like, I loved blacking out right from the start, 14. So my early environmental factors were in my home. I was 14 when I first smoked weed and started popping pills. And yeah.
Well, we have something in common there. First time I tried alcohol by myself was at 13. And it was also the time I also got blackout drunk. And so I also loved the feeling. It was very euphoric. Obviously, that was foreshadowing to the woman that I would become, which is somebody that really struggled with alcoholism and addiction. So from your first sip of alcohol, like that first time you got drunk with your friends or with your friend at 14, what was the like trajectory or timeline between that place? Like, kind of walk us through how drinking or using drugs or popping pills impacted your life from that point moving forward.
From that point on, I was just really curious about trying everything. After I tried that, like throughout high school, it was all just like party mentality. I want to experiment. I want to try everything. The attitude was, I'll try all substances. It will be mind expanding, not mind numbing. Like, I wanted to try hallucinogens, coke, ecstasy. And I kind of already wanted to try harder stuff too. Like, a lot of people when they're using, they're like, oh, I'll never do heroin or I'll never do meth. And right from the start, for whatever reason, I just had that hunger where I was like, I don't give a fuck. Like, I want to try everything, blacking out, like shooting dope. And so the progression was pretty quick. And like ages 14 through 17 was a lot of the hallucinogens. And I was 15 when I first tried meth. And then 17 was the first time I shot opiates, OxyContin, snorted heroin, started shooting heroin. So a very quick downward progression.
That was really young. What age did you get sober?
I was 21.
How many years have you been sober now?
I celebrated 10 years of sobriety on April 19th.
That is incredible. Congratulations. That's such a big,
Thank you.
Number. I'm dreaming of getting to 10 years. Fast life in the beginning. So from 14 to like 21, you're experimenting. I find it really interesting that you didn't have that fine line where you were just like, I want to expand. I want to experience all the feels. I felt like I was somewhat like that, but for me, and there's no rhyme or reason because I've tried like a lot of different things, but for some reason in my mind, I was like, I don't want to inject myself with anything. And I think a lot of people also are like, that's the cutoff, right? I know that naturally that's not how life works. And like, we can all progress and slip into whatever space. And I think alcohol for me was the common denominator for wanting to experiment with drugs. And I'm wondering them, so 21, right? That's the legal age that people are like, I can drink. Supposedly, right? I don't know anyone that's followed that rule, but some people I'm sure out there exist that wait until they're 21. So 21 is like when the party, and I'm definitely air quoting this, the party ended for you. Can you share a little bit about what that looked like and what led you to realizing, okay, I need to stop? Or did you have that realization, or was it more like somebody was like, knock, 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 vegan, no more?
Well, I was 18 the first time I was in juvenile rehab. So that was when the seed of recovery was planted into my mind. I was forced to go to rehab and I didn't want to go. And then the ages 18 through 21, I went to treatment a total of 8 times, including that juvenile, because I knew that I had a physical habit. I do remember when the time came when I wanted to stop and I couldn't, and I'd wake up and I'd be like, dude, like, I'm done, I want to quit. And then, you know, before I knew it, I was doing it again. And it was my 8th time in rehab when I really hit a complete bottom. And I truly believed that if I were to leave that rehab and get high again, which I tried to do, even though I was put in there again, I was trying to check out again. I had a moment where I realized if I left that rehab and I would use, I would probably die. And something in me did not want to die anymore. And that was the moment that I really hit bottom. And I knew for me, like, I can't have any drugs or alcohol at all. None. Complete abstinence, complete sobriety for me.
I'm not so familiar with the chemical dependence. Like, can you explain a little bit about like what dope sick is? Like, how does that feel? Do you remember that feeling?
It's horrible being sick. I mean, now 10 years in recovery, it's been a long time. When I think back on it, I think it sounds really crazy. I don't know why I thought I was gonna experiment or do heroin. And like, I guess maybe I'd never thought of like getting a habit. I just remember there was a time where like I got high with the person I was with at the time. And I was like, oh man, I feel so much better. And they're like, oh, you have a habit. And I'm like, oh my gosh, I didn't realize, I don't know. See, like, I'm like, doesn't that sound so dumb that I was doing heroin and I didn't think of getting an addiction, but it just happened. And what it's like being sick is you wake up, it's kind of like having a hangover, being in withdrawal. Like, you start out like kind of just getting cold sweats and, you know, being uncomfortable, your skin feels uncomfortable. Like, every morning I'd wake up nauseous and dope sick. And like, I mean, it was just, oof, it was really, really bad, really bad. Like, oh man, horrible feeling.
So the first time, I'm assuming, was involuntary. You were like, at 18, you did not want to be there. Like, you were forced to go. Can you fill in the gaps between the first and the 8th time? Not like recounting every single one, because I know this was a long time ago, but the progression from like an involuntary admittance to the final 8th time when you were like, I don't want to die.
Juvenile probation was the factor for me going the first time. And the other times, like, because there was times where it was just like the detox, and like I would do like a 5-6 day detox and leave again. Those 3 years, 18 through 21, the psychological addiction, definitely under, like, now that I'm in recovery and I can really understand what that is, to have a mental obsession and a psychological factor that keeps driving me. And at first it was, you know, I wanted to use and I wanted to get high and I was doing that. And then when I wanted to stop, so I'd be like, oh, okay, I want to stop, and I'd go to treatment and I'd be in treatment. And And then I guess as it would wear off, like it was a little bit of both. Like I would be detoxed with medication, but the psychological factor of like, you know what, the idea had come through, like, you know what, I want to leave here. Like, I don't want to do this. I'm uncomfortable. I want to leave. And then just being like, fuck it. Like, then I'm just going to go. So over time, continuously learning like what that psychological drive is, the mental state, and then the physical compulsion, like doing it over and over again.
Most people don't like to feel uncomfortable. And after you used for years, like I did, like I was an avid drinker. I would dabble in other substances, but like my main thing was drinking. What made me never stick with getting like staying sober is the idea that like one thing would happen and then it's like I could process my feelings, sit in the uncomfortability. But who wants to do that when all I know is using this substance because that is a quick fix. And even though towards the end of my drinking, I didn't want to drink anymore, actually, I was like over it. It was just like the familiarity of it. Like, you know, it's just like a familiar thing that I've always been doing. And even though I knew at that point it was terrible for me and it was ruining my life and all of those things, I still was like, but this is all I know. This is what I know. And so I really like that you said that it was just like the uncomfortability and the psychological impact as well, because obviously there's a physiological standpoint that your body is accustomed to, but it's, I think the mind is something that we don't touch on as much that we need to address. So thank you for sharing that. I'm wondering about the people that were in your life during this time. Who was support for you? Who were your cheerleaders? And who were people who were right in the trenches with you? And then did you lose people along the way? Did you have to cut people off to prioritize yourself?
Yeah, man, I'm actually getting emotional. Oh, man.
Take a deep breath. Take your time. I know it's hard.
Like, damn, I'm really grateful. I can't believe I'm crying this much. I want to try to like make myself laugh to deter myself from crying, but, and my dog just came over. He's so sweet. The parts of the story too, like when you say that, it just makes me want to cry a lot about like who is my support, because honestly, self-help recovery programs have been a huge support for me. So I'm really grateful that those kinds of rooms and spaces were always available, like for someone like me, like a little dope fiend who didn't really give a crap if I lived or died. Like that was a huge support for me to hear that, like, you know, keep coming back no matter what to these places that where people were in recovery and were like, this is what happened to me and I'm in recovery now. That was truly a major support, so much so that it just made me burst into tears right now. If it wasn't for that, like I do believe I would die, because if it wasn't for those places, there probably never even would have been a chance for me to get clean and sober, to be honest.
So, did you feel, Reagan, that people in your immediate circle weren't in a place to be able to support you, so you found help in the rooms and going to, like, I don't know what program you went to, if you went to Narcotics Anonymous or AA or any of the other rooms, but did you feel like the people in your immediate circle, were they sick as well? Were they abusing and so therefore unable to support you?
Yeah, that's part of my story, a huge part of it. And I'm really open about a lot of parts of my story, but it's still kind of new because of being open about my dance career. And then these aspects, like sometimes there's certain parts where in person or off camera, like, you know, I'll share pretty much anything with anyone at any point, but there's certain parts where I'm like, because of family members who are still alive, I've seen a lot of people die from drug addiction, alcoholism. So yeah, the immediate support thing and in my recovery was definitely like group help and county funded rehab.
It works if you work it.
It did.
That's amazing. I'm somebody who is so independent that it's hard for me to lean on people, especially strangers, but that has been the biggest ally in my recovery. I had to lean on strangers supporting me, which that is just like, before this would have been my idea of hell. Like,
I can't even trust people like in my inner circle sometimes to like confide in. And here I am telling a room full of strangers my deepest, darkest secrets. And there was just something so therapeutic and cathartic about that and liberating. Maybe it's the idea that like they don't know me and they've been through what I've been through to where they can't judge me. There's an adage in AA where they say like, oh, we are all terminally unique, which is this idea that like you think that you have this unique story that no one can relate to and you're the worst person in the world. And it's like, girl, let me tell you, like, oh, you did that? I did that too. There's something to do with like somebody who's on the other side showing you the way or showing you that there is a way that is different from the current way that you're living your life. That is just so powerful to me. If it's okay, if we touch on your dancing career, what age did you start dancing? And do you think there was a parallel between your using and drinking with your dancing? And I hope I don't sound ignorant there because I am by no means trying to cast the dancing stripper club scene as, you know, a place where people just use and get high and drink and do all of those things. So I hope I don't sound ignorant, but I have to ask because I'm very curious to know if there was a connection between your like party lifestyle and your professional life.
Yes, I was 18 when I started dancing. It was actually the month of August. So I think it's been like 14 years now that I've been a dancer. I was already getting high when I started dancing. So it wasn't like I went into that environment and started, you know, drinking and using or anything. And I always sort of wanted to be a dancer before I started doing drugs too. And I think that might have been part of the cultural influences of like music and dancing.
So from my understanding, you wanted to be a dancer before. It wasn't connected to how you were using or drinking. It was just something that you already wanted to do. On the scene, do you find, especially from this vantage point as a sober girl, do you see other girls that remind you of yourself?
I feel like it's still a little hard to talk about on social media or on the internet, but there are times where I see certain things and I'm just like, oh my gosh, like I'm concerned. And there are times where I'll have conversations and I'm like, you know, I can share my thoughts and feelings or concerns. And then there's times where I'm like, well, I'm at work and I'm not connected to that person. So like, you know, I could just see or hear things and I just don't say anything at other times, because like when I go to work, I'm in a work mentality. That's why I go to the club. When I go there, I know what my job is, to dance and do dances, and that's what I do. So I'm kind of in that mindset. I do the best I can with, you know, being open with my story in any aspect, or if anyone ever asks me a question, since I'm open about my recovery, like I'm always there and I always share like, what do I do or how do I maintain recovery? And then there's kind of like different levels, because there are times where I've been in clubs where you could tell girls are definitely like on street, like drugs, like, you know, hard shit. And then there's times where it's like, you know, just like a lot of alcohol use, I guess. And so I see and observe things, and I do my best as a person who's in recovery to be available as a sober person. Then there's times where, yeah, like certain things are not any of my business. I don't have a place to say or do anything.
And most people, if they're not ready to change or receive help, you can tell them whatever you want. Like, they're not necessarily going to listen, especially when they're on the substance. From my own personal experiences and from trying to tell people about themselves when I had no place to, people have to be open and receptive to that. Are you working at the same club since you were 21, or have you switched to a different club? I was just wondering, because I'm like, are you in a new environment since being sober, I guess is my question.
Yeah, I got sober in Pennsylvania.
Oh, really?
And I moved moved to Vegas 8 years ago.
That's an interesting move, because most people think Vegas and they think that is the last place on earth I probably would want to be as a sober person. So can you share a little bit about how you navigate sobriety in an industry / location that is fueled with all of the cliche Vegas tropes that we know, insert here? So how do you maintain your sobriety in Vegas?
The same actions that got me sober keep me sober. And I came out the very first time for the pole expo for pole dancing. I came out in 2013,
And then the following year, I came out for the Gentlemen's Club Expo. So keeping that mentality about being work and business has helped me stay sober too, because like, what am I doing and why? And I make it a point to always attend recovery groups and services that are available. Mm-hmm. And doing that has kept me sober.
I gotta ask, because do you remember that movie with J-Lo a couple years ago or a few years ago where she's a stripper? Do you know what I'm talking about?
Yeah, I didn't see it, but I know what one you're talking about. I can't remember what it's called though.
Just a quick connection, and it leads to my question. So basically, they're running like a scheme. J-Lo's character is like the head bitch in charge, and she recruits this like younger woman to help her, and they basically pry. I'm gonna use that word, pry. They basically roofie the dudes, and then they take their credit cards and run up all of these charges because they know that these men are probably not going to report it, because who wants to admit, A, that they've been roofied by two women, and how can you prove it? And also, they don't want their wives or fill in the blank to find out that they were even there to begin with. So they run this scheme. It's based on a true story for like many years and rack up all of this money. But like, the question that I'm wondering for you is, do you have a preference when you're entertaining different clientele? Do you mind if they're drunk? Is that a problem for you? Like, do you find from your experience that it's more menacing or more of an issue when they're drinking too much? I want to get into the weeds of that.
I feel like I'm kind of freezing up on my answer on that.
That's a weird question. I don't imagine you have been asked that before, but like, I want to know who the better client is, like a more sober guy, a drunk client. Like, does that matter? Because, you know, like they say, spectators will come to the club. That's annoying. Like, this is your place of business. And you know what I mean by a spectator, like someone who's just like,
yeah,
a girl that's like, oh, I just want to like look, you know. No, like that's not what you go to work for. But like, I'm just wondering, in terms of like the clients that you actually serve, does it matter their level of intoxication?
Sometimes if someone is overly drunk, it is uncomfortable. I've been dancing for so long, there's so many different like experiences. It's always such an individual moment of like the person I'm talking to at the time. And when I go to work, I'm in such a work mentality that I'm just like, I don't know, that's where my mindset is.
The movie, though, by the way, was called Hustlers. It just came to me. I was like, it's called Hustlers because they were hustlers. But I'm going to make an assumption here and just say that, like, too drunk is bad, but too sober is also not good. Like, I don't know if it makes a difference, but, like, at least from what I've seen in terms of observing men in the club, the more drunk they are, the more money they spend. And that's in any setting. That's not even in the club. That's in any setting, right? And even for me, like, I would be more liberal with my spending when I was drinking. Like, oh, you get a shot. You get a shot. We all get shots. So have you, in the 10 years that you've been sober, have you ever felt triggered at work?
I've had a few triggers in my 10 years of sobriety. They weren't at work necessarily, because truly when I hit that bottom and I knew that I could not drink or use anymore, and I had a full complete spiritual awakening, I mean, that was really it. And my first 6 months of recovery, I didn't work as a dancer, and I went through a very intensive recovery process. And when I made the decision to be a dancer again in sobriety, like, I just had that foundation of being in recovery and sober. And so I just know I can't drink. And as soon as I went back to work as a dancer, I guess like there hasn't been like a lot of like, oh, I want to drink, or I wish I could drink while I'm there, because again, the business mentality of it.
I'm glad that it wasn't at work. You know, this is your profession, so like, you take your job seriously, and when you go to work, that's not what you're thinking about, which is great. Do you remember any of the other triggers that you had? And then I would love to hear a little bit more about the spiritual awakening you had in the first 6 months of your sobriety, because that is big, and I would love to hear more about that as well.
When I got sober, there's that saying, oh man, put down the spoon and picked up the fork. Have you ever heard
that
with food? Because heroin and shooting up that.
Yeah,
that
no, right? I made the connection. I've never heard it, but that's like, amazing.
When I got sober, I really struggled with food and overeating a lot. Early in recovery, I went through a major loss and one of my parents passed away. So that was extremely, thank you, traumatic and painful. And it is part of my story that I stayed sober through that loss. Thank God. Like, thank God I was able to stay sober through that. Even working as a stripper too. I was literally on my way to work when I received this phone call that one of my parents died. And I was nine months into recovery. And it was horrible. I mean, it was definitely a divine intervention that I was sober. Throughout that process, getting newly sober, losing a parent, and then eating a lot of food. Ironically, like working in a club wasn't triggering me to want to drink. I didn't want to pick up a drink. But there was a time with that food process where I was so much overeating. I'm like, dude, if I'm going to get fucking high, like I may as well just do meth if I'm going to, like, this is just, you know, more honesty. Because I'm like, if I'm going to be stuck in this behavior, I may as well just do speed. I'm getting fat. This is horrible. Like, that was a time where I was really truly triggered and actually made a phone call to try and see if, you know, any speed was around. And thank God I called a friend too. And I was just really honest. I was like, look, like I'm trying to, you know, and again, recovery to the rescue. Cause man, crazy just to think like, you know, that friend and I doing the deal, going to where we need to go to stay clean and sober. So truly, like, you know, being in the club or working in the club, I mean, there may have been a couple times where like I could smell alcohol, and there's times where I'm like, you know, and I'll take that moment of awareness and be like, whoa, like to just think, you know, it's right there. But it's true that it's my mental state. Like, it doesn't matter if I'm in the club or right next to alcohol, I could be closer to it mentally anywhere else. It's that, like, I'm fully aware it's my mental state before I pick up a drink in or out of the club. Like, it doesn't really matter. It's that mental state.
Absolutely. I commend you for like being able to go through something as difficult as losing a parent in the early stages of your sobriety and stay sober. Like, that is just like, you've accomplished the world to me just hearing that. People don't understand how hard that can be as somebody that struggles with addiction. And I'm really proud of you, as you I'm sure you're proud of yourself. There was something you said that I really thought was so beautiful, which is this idea that like you were closer in your mind than physically being close to a bottle. This is green tea, but you know what I mean? Like, you could smell the like, that's not as close as you are in your mind to slipping. Like, I could literally hold a bottle of anything now, Hennessy, Courvoisier, whatever the thing that you drink, right? And be not tempted. But if I'm not in the right mind space, like, I will go the extra mile. I've walked through a blizzard before to get to a wine shop. I've gone the extra mile. So I really think that that was a beautiful way to put it. And I'm glad that you called your friend before buying speed when you were worried about weight gain and you were worried about slipping and you were in that fragile state. So I'm really glad that that friend was like, let's go to a meeting or let's not do that. Like, that was amazing, and you had someone to lean on. So just as we wrap up, I'm just wondering, Reagan, is there anything else that you want to share? I'm very curious. I know that you kind of touched on things that are working for you to maintain your sobriety, but I'm also wondering what specific advice you would give to someone who wants to get clean, who wants to put down the spoon, for example, and pick up the fork, or who wants to just change and not be in a space where they're living their life in a perpetual cycle that they know is not going to end well for them.
Thank you again for having me on your show. Words that I would give to anyone stuck in a cycle: building that positive support group is really helpful, whether it's, you know, drug and alcohol addiction or anything else that you're struggling with. Having friendships and relationships with people where you can be really honest about your mental and emotional state and what's really going on, and that can help you process and see things, and to help you acknowledge like, okay, well, what is the positive action then that I want to take for whatever struggle that I'm in? Having people around you that can help you stay accountable. And I think that, yeah, like living an overall healthy life, like going to the gym regularly, taking time for prayer and meditation and silent time, journaling, there's so many healthy tools and exercises that we can use that have helped me stay sober and off of drugs and alcohol and to also help my mental health. Those things really work. I think your one thing too about the essential oils.
Yes, I love essential oils. I always keep some in my bag. I know that's crazy, like, but I do. It's like a quick way. I think there is some science behind it, like with smell and your olfactory gland or whatever. But like when I'm stressed or when I feel like a trigger is coming, I will just like smell it directly or I'll rub some on me and it calms me. Yeah, totally into the essential oils.
I also wouldn't necessarily recommend, like when we were talking about, you know, smelling alcohol, I wouldn't really recommend, like, if you're, you know, an alcoholic or a drug addict to be smelling alcohol. I was just relating the experience that, oh, at work, like if I'm around it. And that's where that separation is, though, is in recovery is, well, now I can acknowledge what that is to have a boundary now between me and a drink or a drug. Like, I know in my beingness that like I just can't even drink even one. And sometimes, like, you know, people say like, oh, you're not really totally sober, I'm sure she probably has drank during the weekend at least once on a stripper shift or something like that. And I'm like, dude, no,
bro,
like
no.
I know I'm a dope fiend. If I was gonna do something, I would just straight up go like right for the hard shit, because that's how I'm wired. So that's probably another reason I don't care I'm around alcohol. I'm like, dude, if I'm gonna go back to something, like, I'm sorry, I'm not gonna be drinking. Like, I know that. Like, I know that's insanity.
It's awareness. You have awareness, and that is important. Like, my drug of choice is definitely alcohol, and that's the first thing I would reach for. Like, forbidden, unrequited love. And I'm just like, I love and hate you at the same time. So like, yeah, I also don't recommend sniffing or smelling or being close to the substance that you abused at all. It's just like with an ex-lover, like, you know, get away from him. He is toxic. Do not go back over there. I definitely understand that. I just met the analogy, which is like really in your head. It can be more dangerous to be romanticizing or thinking about something in your head than to physically have it near you in proximity. Like, I think that is really real, because if I'm going to use, I will cross heaven and earth and hell and all of the things to get what I want. So it doesn't really matter if it's like convenient for me or not. It's all about like my mindset. I also just wanted to know if there was anything that you wanted to share in terms of destigmatizing industry that you work in, or even Vegas. Like, is there anything that you feel like should be cleared up in terms of misconceptions around dance culture, club culture, things like that? This is a good place to do that, because so many people have preconceived notions of what it's like to be a dancer.
I love that you asked that. And I think one of the stigmas I would want to clear up is, well, the negative view a lot of people have of strippers, entertainers, the adult industry. It's such an individual thing, like to know the what and why of each person there. Like, I'm sober and in recovery. So sometimes like I see that side, like where women in recovery are like, you know, I felt degraded when I worked as a dancer, or this or that. And like, I hear that a lot, and I'm like, oh, okay, that's your story. And like, to acknowledge that it can be a negative for them. Like, I definitely want to give like shout outs and like big good vibes to like the women that I work with regularly. Like, it's been for me, like the women that I work with, I love like our locker room conversations. There's other women who don't drink, and so many women doing positive things, like putting themselves through school, supporting their kids, like positive things. And like, I get to see that all the time. And so I know from the outside, there's the judgment, dude. The judgment is so hard and can be so heavy. And so I just want to take a moment to like high five all my dance friends, like high five all the badass babes who I know, like, in their mind, in their heart, in their spirits are like in a good place doing good things. And for my whole entire industry, like, even when I retire from dancing, I'm always going to have a special place in my heart for the strip club industry and strip clubs, because it's a huge part of my story. And like, my love is truly in the clubs. That would probably be it. Just my love and gratitude that, like, even though dancing is a shorter term career, but for the women and the men too, the men in the industry, managers, bouncers, DJs, there's male dancers too. So the genuine good-heartedness of the humans in the industry to just stop judging us.
Amen to that. I have so much respect for dancers. Like you said, everyone has their story and their why. And of course, you know, you can ask someone anything about their experience in any industry, law, education, medical fields, and people are going to have negative connotations around it. And then people are going to have positive connotations. And I think a lot of it has to do with obviously your individual makeup. You seem like a badass to me just in hearing bits of your stories. Like, you always wanted to be a dancer. Why is that looked down upon? Like, that should be commended. Like, you knew what you wanted to do. You went after it and you made success. And I am so glad that you were able to clear some of that up, because I think a lot of more people need to understand that there is no shame and there should not be any shame when it comes to dancing, just like there is no shame and there should not be any shame when it comes to addiction. So thank you for sharing that, Reagan. I think so many people will respect that. Thank you, Reagan, so much for coming on and kind of like just demystifying what it's like to be a stripper in recovery. I think that's so powerful and badass. And I also just really appreciated hearing more about your story, your why, and what inspires and keeps you sober. So thank you. I learned a lot as well. And I look forward to continued support. And if I'm in Vegas, I will have to holler at you. Yes. You also re-inspired me, because I'm like, there's certain places I'm afraid to go to. And for some reason in my mind, well, not for some reason, the last time I was in Vegas, it was a shit show. I was blacked out pretty much the whole time. So I think that's why I'm like afraid, but you inspired me. Like, I might need to hit the desert back up. Head
come
over
there. Come visit.
Hi, Simba. So cute. Oh my gosh. Thank you so much for coming on. I really appreciate
you.
Bye.
I appreciate you.